Hello and welcome back to the Institutional Beat podcast, where we cover interesting and relevant topics for institutional investors. I'm your host, Slava Sherbatov, and today we're going to talk about active management of equities in the current market environment. It is no secret that the last few years have been challenging for fundamental active managers to deliver outperformance, especially in large cap US and global equity markets. And we're pleased to have what we think is the perfect guest to help us understand this environment and how to manage through it, Stu Cadwell, Global Head of Equities at RBC Global Asset Management. Stu, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Slava. How you doing?
Pretty good. And how are you doing?
Great. Thanks for having me today.
No, it's a pleasure. We know you're a popular guest on another podcast that that we host as a firm. So we got you were able to squeeze us into your busy schedule.
Yeah.
Well, before we start, Stu, I'm just going to take a minute and introduce you. As many of our listeners know you, I know you've met many of our clients over the years, but some may not. And so just a couple words about Stu. He is one of our most experienced investment leaders, having spent his entire 30-year career with our firm in progressively senior roles, from investment analyst to portfolio manager to co-head of North American Equities. And in fact, Stu was instrumental in building out our North American equity team alongside his longtime partner, Doug Raymond. And most recently, taking on the role of Global Head of Equities, overseeing all of our equity teams. Stu also sits on our firm's leadership committee, as well as investment strategy committee, which sets the tactical asset mix across our multi-asset portfolios. In addition to all of this, and Stu, hopefully you agree with this, but I think you are known as one of the more interesting people to talk to about markets, not just because of your knowledge and insights, but also because of various quotes and analogies that you use to bring concepts to life. So no pressure, but hopefully we can get a couple of those out of you today as well.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. So before we get to the main question, can you just take a minute and talk about the equity franchise that you oversee and your role as the global head of equities at the firm?
Yeah, for sure. Well, you know, we're very fortunate here because we have equity management across every region and every style of money management. And, you know, you mentioned that I was, you know, I taken on our global teams this year. You know, before that, all the North American teams, you know, were under our purview. And, you know, we really thought that that benefited us by, you know, having growth, value, dividend, core, long short across US and Canadian markets, having that all in the same team. You know, you could have these, you know, we're big fans of scenario analysis, and you could have these very fulsome debates around a topic because, you know, you have two different teams approaching the same stock from a different mentality. And, you know, this year we've expanded that. So, you know, now we have our Asian equity team, which is based in Hong Kong. We have our global, our EM, and our European equity teams based in London, and our mid-cap and small and mid-cap equity team based in Chicago. And of course, you know, our North American team included what we do in Vancouver and what we do in Toronto. And, you know, I think it's just been a huge benefit, you know, diversity of opinion, you know, diversity of thought, which is a crucial component to the investment business. You know, we've really benefited from that. And then, you know, the other thing as a team, you know, we sit down and we spend a lot of time talking about investment process. Investment process is what gets the job done through, you know, many years and many different cycles. So we've all presented our investment processes to each other. You know, I think in one form or another, there's three components. There's, you know, identifying good businesses, identifying which ones we want to own, and portfolio construction. And any investment team has, you know, some focus on, you know, those three things. You know, you mentioned my partner, Doug Raymond. He used to say, like, which horses go in the barn, which horses come on the track, and, you know, how do you kind of suit them up, meaning which weight do you put them in and what have you. So, you know, so we're looking at portfolios in those three dimensions everywhere in the world. Each team has a portfolio engineer, which, you know, we've changed that, you know, or I wouldn't say necessarily changed, but, you know, we've augmented some of the focus of those teams, you know, through the year. And, yeah, we're very fortunate to have this, you know, massive resource.
Yeah, Thanks, Stu. And I think a lot of the things you just described also puts you in a pretty good position to speak to this next question. And I pointed out in the beginning that it has been a tough period for active management. And, you know, admittedly, we certainly have not been entirely immune from this in some parts of our business, but it has been a general theme in our industry. For example, you know, depending on the source that you look at, it's not uncommon to see major large cap indices, whether it's S&P 500, MSCI World, or even home market, rank pretty close to the top quartile in terms of performance, dating back not just this year, but three and 5 years. And for reference, we're recording this in October of 2025. So can you talk about what's been driving this and why it's been so difficult to outperform in some of these markets?
Yeah, so when markets are what I call, when markets are concentrating, right? So the larger stocks, the larger index weights are getting larger. That's a challenge for active management if you don't have a full exposure to those companies. Traditionally, you know, active managers had this benefit that if my portfolio beat the average stock in the index, I outperformed. That was always, you know, one of the keys to EM. It was one of the keys to global. You know, for a lot of years, it was the key to the U.S. And that has changed. It started in the United States, but that has changed quite dramatically because of the concentration at the top of the stock markets. Now, it's interesting, as a Canadian investor, you know, and this goes back to the diversity of the franchises, a lot of Canadian money managers went through this with Nortel, where a stock climbed to, you know, 38% or 36% of the index, whatever it reached at its zenith. And owning it or not owning it was the deciding factor of portfolio management. And you know, there were managers that owned it, and then they were smart on the way up, and then they still owned it when it went down, and all of a sudden, you know, they weren't viewed quite the same, and vice versa. People that didn't own it on the way up then became, you know, kind of brilliant on the way down. And this one stock, you know, really defined your longer term, you know, track record. And you know, Canadian markets have always been a function, because they're quite concentrated, they've always been a bit of a function of what you own and what you don't own really defines your performance. And, you know, so Canadians, I think, were kind of used to this. So, you know, when the U.S. market started to concentrate, you know, we focused a lot on portfolio construction. And, you know, unfortunately, other markets around the world, even like small cap land, which, you know, again, like, you know, beating the average stock used to always define a good performance in the small cap land. You know, this year, like, the average stock in the small cap index is hundreds of basis points behind the small cap index, which, you know, that's just very rare, even in that universe where, you know, you're capping the size of the largest companies. But even in those ones, the largest companies have dominated performance.
We do often talk about outperforming any given benchmark is never easy, even under normal circumstances, if there is such a thing. I don't know. And you just flagged a few things that might get in the way or managers have to contend with today. So what can you do about it? And, you know, without giving away any secrets, what are some of the things that you think are important for managers to focus on to kind of help help navigate through this market environment?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things. I think, you know, the first is, you know, for a long time, when you made, you know, the decision to kind of own the index, what you were signing up for, particularly in the S&P 500, was getting exposure to this long, you know, long pattern of around 7% earnings growth from the S&P 500. And, you know, so if you bought the index, you kind of collected the earnings growth and a little bit of a dividend to get, you know, not an unreasonable equity market return. And, you know, sometimes active managers beat it and sometimes they didn't. But, you know, there was much greater outperformance during that period of time. But some people just said, well, I'm a long-term investor. So, you know, what's most important to me is that 7% earnings growth. You know, today, the S&P is still growing its earnings, but the earnings growth has been heavily dominated by a handful of companies. And those companies are now very large inside of the index. So, you know, choosing passive, and it's whether or not it's the S&P or globally, it has become, you know, a more active decision than it may have been in the past, because you are very exposed to, you know, the earnings that have been created by a handful of companies. And, you know, these companies have very strong financial characteristics, But you know, the history of the top companies remaining at the top for long periods of time is not great. Like, you can go back through time, and every decade, the top companies rarely are the new top companies, you know, kind of 10 years later. So, you know, so that's you know, that, you know, before we get into some of the challenges, like, you know, even like, you know, if you buy the TSX as a passive investor, you really need to make three decisions around gold, energy, and financial stocks, because those are three large components that are going to have some impact on how the headline index does. You know, historically on the S&P, you didn't really have to worry about that because it was very differentiated. Now it's, again, it's quite exposed to what, you know, the Magnificent Seven. And as a consequence of its growth, the global index looks not dissimilar, because, you know, the U.S. has gone from around 50% of global stock markets to around 70%. You know, if you look in the last 10 years, U.S. stock markets have almost doubled relative to the rest of the world. And you've seen this big hike in their weight. And then, so even within the global index, you have some of these, you know, concentration and implications that you have in the S&P. As far as concentration implications are concerned, like, you know, we can look at the TSX, where, you know, the Royal Bank is not a dissimilar weight in the TSX as NVIDIA is in the S&P 500. You know, it's really what we then have to go into on these indexes that have concentration is the scenario analysis and the range of outcome for each business under its, you know, under that weight, right? And you know, so you can take a business like the Royal Bank and say, boy, over a long period of time, the return on equity might be X at the peak. It might be like X maybe minus 300 basis points during the trough, but it's a narrower range of outcomes. So you don't feel, you know, quite as vulnerable as a long-term investor in, you know, holding, you know, that percentage of your capital in that stock. When it comes to, you know, some of the larger businesses in the S&P 500, the margin profiles of these businesses are nothing short of stunning. And the persistence of those margin profiles is, you know, I think that's probably the major concern or question mark around, you know, those businesses. The revenue growth has been spectacular, but, you know, Microsoft, all of these companies have witnessed this not only very strong revenue growth, but spectacular margin expansion at the same time. So when we go forward and we look at the scenarios, you know, you might have earning or revenue growth that, you know, doubles or triples, you know, nominal GDP, but will the margin profile hold? And, you know, you kind of have, you know, both revenue and the margin profile holding as a source of risk in, you know, some of the larger indices in the S&P 500 relative to what you may have had historically. You know, for active managers, you know, you're doing scenario analysis all the time. So, you know, the three ways that, you know, traditionally you would make money in a stock are the revenue would grow, the margins would expand, and the valuation might expand. And sometimes you get all three. You know, that's where I say, like, you know, when you get into, you know, those top companies where, you know, the S&P is trading at, you know, 22 or 23 times earnings, which is elevated relative to history, you know, justifiable if the margins stay here, because with wide margins, you get a lot of free cash conversion, which attracts a higher multiple. But, you know, within that 22 or 23, you have, you know, kind of the tale of two markets, which is, you know, seven or eight businesses that trade at meaningful premiums, and the average stock, you know, still trading in a mid to high teens multiple situation. So as active managers, you have to kind of, you know, think through, do I want to own these businesses? And then if I decide I want to own them, you have to think about the portfolio construction and, you know, whether or not you're running a core mandate or a mandate with a very specific overlay like value or dividend or growth, that's going to have implications, you know, to how you construct your portfolio as well.
Got it. And Stu, you talked a little bit about the, you know, different philosophies and different processes that our teams follow. And we spend a lot of time talking to clients about this as well. And the fact that generally speaking, philosophy and process, they don't change over time. They're pretty consistent. But what can and does change are the different tools that managers can use to execute successfully on that process. And you talked a little bit about scenario analysis potentially as one of the things that can help. Are there any other tools or ideas that that you're thinking about that may be helpful in this context?
Well, you know, so the three, you know, the three primary, you know, as a portfolio manager, you're always looking for things that trigger you to ask questions about your portfolio, right? So, you know, the stocks I own, should I continue to own them? Or should I continue to own them at the weight that I own them? You know, so what causes that trigger? You know, your scenario analysis. So if the stock, you know, starts to really approach your bull case and you have a bunch of other companies you like that are still, you know, factoring in the base case, you know, that's an obvious reason to switch. You know, quantitatively, you know, we have a big quantitative practice here. We didn't, you know, I probably didn't give it its credit even in the opening salvo when I was, you know, focused more on some of the fundamental teams. We have a great quantitative practice here. So we have a quantitative model that, you know, takes stocks in a market and ranks them by deciles. And when you look over time, the first decile outperforms the second decile, outperforms the third decile, and so forth. So, you know, you can give the portfolio manager, even the fundamental portfolio manager, and say, yeah, here you have some companies in lower deciles. You know, should we re-underwrite or rethink about our fundamental thesis because this model is suggesting that, you know, maybe something is challenged. You know, we're not big, you know, we don't use technical analysis to buy and sell stocks. You know, you mentioned the quotes on my wall. You know, one of them is Barton Biggs, which was, you know, when I go hunting, I take my dog, but I don't give him the gun. And, you know, technical analysis in our minds is that it is a reflection of the conversation that's taking place in the marketplace. And when stocks are bottoming and momentum is going from negative to positive, you know, we want to have a system that forces the fundamental analyst to envision what might the stock market be sniffing out. And the same thing if a business starts to top where, you know, it's saying, well, this company is starting to lose momentum. Should we go back and think fundamentally, is everything actually as good as we thought? And then, you know, you can look at things like estimate revision and revenue revision and you know, forward indicators on both of those. So we have all these, you know, mechanisms that, you know, kind of you take back to the portfolio manager and they're just a way of questioning, right? And, you know, I got a bazillion things on my wall, but, you know, one of them is it's not being wrong that kills you, it's staying wrong that kills you. So these questions go back to the portfolio manager and it's just a way of saying, like, are we sure about this? And you know, that's awfully important when it comes to, you know, the different tools that are in place. So, you know, it's not just like, oh, I'm going to own these 30 stocks for the rest of my life. You know, I own these 30 stocks, which I like, or whatever the number of stocks is. And then I constantly question their role in the portfolio.
You also gave a couple of examples earlier with one was with Nortel and the other one with how, you know, leadership can change over time in the stock market. We actually referenced those very same things in a in our seminar earlier this year that we hosted for clients all across the country. And so, you know, you talked a bit about some of the challenges, some of the tools of how investors can approach this. And I know you're a student of history and student of the markets. This is clearly not the first time this is happening, probably not the last time. Can you talk a little bit about, in general, you know, how could these things play out potentially over time? So when you are thinking about different scenarios, what are some of the scenarios that you're contemplating based on, you know, how things might have played out in the past? Doesn't mean it's going to repeat itself here today, but just to give people some context for how to think about it.
Yeah, so like right now, there's been a lot of strength out of the financial sector, the industrial sector, and the technology sector. And, you know, so from a technology or from a financial standpoint, you know, stress testing a financial company is, you know, a little bit more straightforward because you can go look at their loan book and you can make some assumptions around the potential for provisions for credit. You can look at reserves. and say, could this company need more reserves? You know, in Canada, our banks have been putting up a fair amount of reserves, actually. So, you know, feel okay about that. But, you know, so you have that component. Then the industrial and the technology sector have been heavily, you know, focused on data centers and the build out for artificial intelligence. So, you know, there's a couple of things that you can, you know, and as I say, when you look at a lot of these big technology companies, you kind of quickly look at the margin profile. It's not whether or not revenues are going to keep growing. It's really, you know, the margin profile in our minds. So we have a group here, you know, that we're studying, you know, the effectiveness of data center economics a lot, right? So, you know, when you take a data center, you're taking power, you're constructing the facility, you need some coolant, HVAC, then you need a bunch of servers, and those servers produce a bunch of tokens or a bunch of units that you can sell, you know, to users of artificial intelligence, whether or not it's for training or for inference. And, you know, the economics of that facility will be highly dependent on the price that you produce the tokens for and the demand for them. And, you know, the thing that's interesting there is, you know, the speed with which new servers are becoming more efficient. And does that affect the economics at all of in-place capacity? You know, so this would be a way, you know, spending a lot of time on data center economics, you may or may not own a specific data center company, but this is going to be quite important to the revenue growth and the margin profile of some of those larger businesses. So we're spending, you know, a lot of time in that to try and, you know, come up with, you know, scenarios about, you know, how those businesses could progress into the future. So, you know, anytime, you know, you're making an investment, whether or not it's the market as a whole or a company, you say, well, what is the bull case? What is the bear case? Debate, and where does the stock sit relative to that? You know, and you know, we've been in an environment where good news kind of keeps getting put into these stocks a little bit more. There's a lot of, you know, positive momentum. There's single days options. You know, we mentioned passive. There's the triple Q, which augments the amount of money that flows to some of these names and portfolios. You know, but once something gets to, you know, maybe more advanced than even your bull case, then you want to be very wary should one of the indicators we talked about before start to flash red. Quantitatively, the business starts to change, or technically the business starts to change, because you know from your scenario work that it's quite elevated, maybe relative to your base case assumption.
Got it. Thanks, Dave. I think one thing that's clear is while you are global head of equities, I think you're an investment analyst at heart. That's probably will now change. And I think it's having seen you communicate and engage with different members of the team, it comes through all the time as well. Now you did touch on passive a couple of times. We talked about this as well before we started recording, and you kind of talked a little bit about what passive investments used to represent versus what you perhaps are buying today. Can you just, and I know you may be repeating yourself a little bit, but could you just revisit that? Because I thought some of those comments were quite insightful.
Like if you look at a graph of the long-term earnings growth of the S&P 500, it's around 7%. And, you know, that's been through all sorts of environments. You know, sometimes it dips below and then it rebounds back to trend. But, you know, like even if you were at the you know, peak of the financial crisis, the S&P, you know, the earnings forecast was, you know, for 2008, I think was $100 when we started 2008, and you know, earnings ended up bottoming around 60, largely because of a lot of write-offs in the financial sector. But if you bought the S&P at 15 or 1600, and you're paying 16 times earnings on the eve of the financial crisis, you know, 10 years later, the earnings of the S&P were around 200. Like, they grew around 7%. And the fact that, you know, Bank of America and Citigroup were big companies, but they weren't big weights in the index, the fact that they, you know, fell away and new companies picked up the ball and ran with it on the earnings front, it didn't really affect your success as a passive investor. You know, today, you sit there with a lot of exposure to seven or eight names, and those seven or eight names do have linkages. They're not they're not all dependent on each other, but some of them, like there is some codependence around the success of artificial intelligence and what have you. So it might be a little bit more challenging for the market today if those 40% are not compounding at that rate. Like if they stumbled, it's harder for the other 60% to pick up the ball and run with it quite the way that it might have happened in the past.
Mm-hmm. And this is probably where active approach may actually pay off, even though it's been more difficult to deliver in the last little while.
Well, yeah, the role that, passive has received a lot of flows, because of some of the thesis that, we just discussed. It's just, I do think it's changing a little bit. It doesn't mean, it's just the range of outcomes or what it depends on is different than it might have been at the initial onset.
Right.
We look through, we look through all of our active funds, and, I know we're going to talk about this, so I'll just, kind of segue to it. Like, we look through all our active funds and we look at performance in four buckets. We look at the alpha that comes from the stocks we own. We look at the negative alpha that comes from the stocks we own. We look at the positive alpha that comes from the stocks we don't own. And we look at the negative alpha from the stocks that we don't own. And, you can look through performance, but right now that fourth bucket is impacting a lot of investors, which is, the active way of saying, I don't have quite the same exposure to a bunch of stocks that the index does. And, so far that decision hasn't necessarily proved fruitful, but, over the fullness of time, maybe it's worth adding into, a variety of exposures. Like when we look across our performance across our firm, like the first bucket's quite healthy, which is what you would want from an active manager. The second bucket, in certain instances, like we've tightened up some of our, what we call this kind of tsunami warning, like that we talked about at the beginning, the usage of quantitative analysis and things like this, like putting a warning system in front of people that says, it's flashing on the stock. Should we go and rethink it? I think that's like, no matter what, that's going to be an important bucket. And then, bucket three used to be very large for active managers because, say when the market wasn't as concentrated, you might have, I don't know what it is, 20, 30, 40% of the market underperforming by, 8 to 10% or something like that. That used to generate you like, say 400 basis points of performance. Today, that bucket has maybe shrunk in half, so it's only generating you half the performance that it once did. And bucket four is very large because it's growing as the market concentrates. Bucket four has gotten even bigger. Will there be a day that bucket four moves back to bucket three? That's kind of like the dream of the active manager to some degree. But in the grand scheme of a portfolio, I think if you're looking at managers and bucket one is pretty healthy, bucket one is what, at the end of the day, we buy equities to compound our money at earnings growth plus. And that equation of bucket one is revenue growth, margin expansion, valuation expansion. These are tried and tested tools, whether or not you're in private equity, whether or not you're in public equity. That's what you're really looking to fill your portfolio with, because those are the businesses that come with these positive options. And when they present themselves, we're not entirely sure, but that's what really drives good long-term risk-adjusted returns. If you find someone who's been hamstrung by bucket four, you're probably willing to be more patient with them, in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, and bucket four, just to remind everyone again, it's the negative alpha from securities not owned in the portfolio. The one thing
yeah,
I was
like
going to
add, like as an example, like if you haven't had enough NVIDIA,
right,
then exactly. That's like bucket four is, you know, is could be quite large if you haven't had exposure to a handful of stocks.
Yeah. You know, you've given us a couple of quotes and references, so thank you for that. The one saying that you use from time to time that really resonates with me is that every storm eventually runs out of rain, and I think it's a stretch to, you know, categorize the environment for active as a storm, but there are definitely some clouds, and I think it's probably fair to say. But is there a silver lining? And I think there are some things you've already kind of touched on in terms of why investors should feel comfortable, assuming there is, you know, good consideration for some of the things that you talked about throughout the podcast. But are there other things that you may be able to point to give you a little bit of comfort in terms of silver lining in the outlook for active management in the next little while?
Well, I think, you know, like when you think about, you know, like the long term, the long term kind of aspect of active management used to be on the way up, I'll try and keep pace. And on the way down, I'm, you know, active managers are normally pretty good at risk management, right? Like, you know, the kind of the same thing that's maybe kept them out of having a full weight and some of the very spectacular socks is, you know, that's basically a comment saying like I'm unwilling to take that risk that the market's willing to take, right? Like, if you took a company like, you know, Palantir at whatever time sales it is, like as, you know, fantastic as the revenue growth is, by saying I'm not owning Palantir, you might be saying I don't like the business, or you might just be saying I'm unwilling to accept the price of that business, right? Like, the stock market is a big scale. You have the valuation and the business. And, you know, if one gets too far advanced, then you're just pulling forward too much of the future into today's valuation. In a decline, you know, that, you know, an active manager should be able to, you know, identify, you know, some of those risks. And, you know, everyone says, well, what's the point of owning an active manager when markets go down? Why wouldn't I just not own the market? Which is, you know, which is valid. But at the same time, you know, when we're long-term investing, you know, how you put your track record together over a long period of time is you know, a combination of keeping track, or like you either keep track and outperform on the way up, and then don't go down as much when the market goes down, or, you know, it's some combination of those two things. And, you know, I think you could probably make the argument that the longer we get into, you know, the bull market, you know, the active manager might be a spot, that kind of protects capital, you know, should we go sideways. Or, you know, like the interesting thing is that, you know, these, it's not even like the top stocks need to go down. They just need to really start to go sideways. And, you know, the same like in the tech bubble, you know, the large companies went down, although they didn't have very much representation in the S&P. The Fed started cutting interest rates and the rest of the economy took off, right? So in this instance, you know, maybe we could have those stocks digest their gains and other companies start to do better as maybe we get some monetary stimulus or something like that. So, you know, there's lots of ways to bake the cake. I think over time, you know, as I say, as investors, like we want to attach ourselves to earnings growth, dividends, margin expansion, hopefully valuation expansion. And, you know, some of those ingredients look, you know, more fully priced in, you know, some of those, you know, big names.
Thank you, Stu. And maybe that's a good place to wrap it up. You give us lots of things to think about, and really appreciate your insights and transparency in how we approach these markets and what we're doing even within our own team. So thank you very much for joining us. Thank you for your time. And I also want to thank our listeners. I hope you enjoyed this podcast and will join us next time. Thank you.
Thanks, Lava.
This content is provided for general information only and does not constitute financial, tax, legal, or accounting advice and should not be relied upon in that regard. Neither PHNN Institutional nor any of its affiliates accepts any liability for loss or damage arising from the use of the information contained in this podcast.